to the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, skill versus luck. We're up all night to get lucky. We're up all night to get lucky. In the late 90s, poker exploded because suddenly you could play it online. You could gamble on poker anywhere, anytime, for real money. And forget about going to Vegas. There were people making a living playing online poker at home in their pajamas. But then came, wait for it, Black Friday. April 15th, 2011, the day the federal government shut down the top three online poker gambling sites. They froze accounts, indicted executives, sent some of them to jail. And all those people who were making a living playing poker had to find something else to do. But here's the thing. Remember I said we're talking about skill versus luck? Well, the law that shut down internet gambling, it's called the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, that law has a loophole. It turns out it's not all internet gambling that's against the law. It's wagering on games that are subject to chance. And game designer, actually gaming legend, Jason Rohrer, took this loophole as a challenge.
I looked at the law and I read all the text of it. I was like, oh, so what if we could make a game that is not subject to chance that people would still feel like, hey, this is a game I might actually gamble on, right? Sort of threading through the loophole in the law perfectly at the same time making a game that was a compelling gambling game.
Okay, so what'd you come up with?
So I realized that, okay, so we can't have any random number generators. We can't have rolling dice. We can't have cards. We can't have a computer picking numbers out of a hat in any way, right?
Because that would be chance.
That would be chance. You can't do that. So you still need to have hidden information, right? You can't gamble and bet on something if both players know exactly what the state of the game is. So the hidden information has to come from the players. So my new game is called Cordial Minuet. There's a grid of numbers. It's a 6x6 grid. It looks pretty much like a bingo card with numbers from 1 to 36 kind of arranged in a pattern. Now, instead of bingo where, you know, you pull a ball out of a hopper and tell which number has been picked, the players are picking the numbers. One player is picking columns on the grid and the other is picking rows. And they're doing this in secret. And then those columns intersect after each turn, giving each player a number, one of the numbers from 1 to 36 that adds into their score. But as the columns get removed from the grid, there's more and more information appearing about what your opponent may have gotten on the first turn, on the second turn, and then finally on the third turn. And that's what you're betting on along the way.
So it's a little bit like Battleship.
It is a little bit. Yeah, you're like saying like E5, essentially. But your opponent doesn't know that you picked E5.
So, Jason, you said you had to create a game that was all skill, no chance. So there's no chance in this. Everything is under the control of the players. But what's the skill? What do you need to do well to win?
What you need to do well to win in this game is to learn to read your opponent's mind. And even if you've never played against them before, you can look at it and say, well, if I was them, what row would be attractive to me? What would I pick if I was them?
But this is online. So you're playing a perfect stranger and you can't even see them.
You can't even see them. And there's no chat. There's no other communication outside of the game, the communication that takes place through the game itself.
So the original point of this game was to exploit this loophole in the law so that you could create an online game that people could gamble real money for. But what's the point for you of the gambling real money? I mean, all the other games online that are really popular, you can gamble and play, but for virtual currency, you know, virtual gold, virtual jewels, or whatever.
Right. And in this game, you can only play for real money, right? So I allow people to play all the way down to a penny, where like each player puts a penny into the game and you're fighting over fractions of a penny. Because I found that, you know, when I was playing poker for real money, it kind of brought the drama and the real-life impact of the game to like a very different level than what I was experiencing in games where the consequences weren't real. And I really like games that somehow reach out into the real world and kind of affect the real world in some way.
Well, the other thing is, the fact that it's real money, I assume, means that in order to play the game, people have to give you their credit card information.
Right, right.
That's the point at which it feels real.
Yeah. You come to this website, and then you load the game up, and then the first thing it shows you is, here, enter your credit card, and tell me how much money you want to deposit. You can deposit anywhere from $2, which is the bare minimum, all the way up to $999,000. I mean, assuming that your credit card limit goes that high.
What's the highest stake anybody's played for?
There was a one point in time a couple of months ago where a self-described .com millionaire came into the game. He had played some of my games in the past, and I've actually gotten to know him over the years. It's kind of an interesting story because he started off playing, a $5 game and lost. And then the players he was playing against, who were established and good, were willing to follow him up. He then played a $10 game, and they joined him. And then he lost that and went up to 20, then 50, then 100. He kept losing on purpose. Then he got up to $500 games. And he was like, now I'm playing for real stakes that I care about. I've lured these people up. And then he tried to start playing for real and, of course, still didn't know how to play. So over the course of a couple of days, he lost something like $6,000, mostly to one person, who was this college kid who had like never gambled before and just had put a, you know, $15 into the game or whatever. And all of a sudden he's sitting on like $6,000 and he's like, whoa, what happened to me here?
So I want to ask you about the design of the game. So you said it looks a little bit like a, you know, a bingo board. But I have to say, you know, looking at it, what it actually looks like is a bingo board created by medieval monks, because it's
right.
It's got all these weird arcane symbols on the side. In fact, the entire site, frankly, looks a little sketchy. So why?
Yeah, so when I set out to make this game, I started reading the history of gambling, right? And I found that there's this intimate connection between gambling and fortune-telling and religion and the occult, people rolling the bones to commune with the gods or do fortune-telling and then using the same bones on the weekends to gamble with. And, you know, even if you think about, like, a modern casino, it's kind of like a giant cathedral. And one of my game designer friends likes to say it's like, you know, this temple where we go to sacrifice a bit of our hard-earned money on the altars of the gods of chaos, right? So anyway, I decided that I wanted to make a game that was both an occult ritual and a gambling game kind of rolled into one. And so that grid of numbers that you see that looks like a bingo card is actually a magic square. This is an ancient numerical device that's part of numerology and magic rituals that goes way back. I mean, you can find magic squares carved into some of the most ancient temples in the world.
Wait, what makes something a magic square?
So a magic square is a grid of numbers, and they're arranged in such a way where each row and each column sums to the same amount, and each diagonal. But if you think about it, I've got six rows, and each row sums to 111. So that is actually where, in part, where the number 666 comes from, is from the 6x6 magic square. And when I was sitting down with that magic square and just testing it for gameplay purposes, and I added the numbers up in my calculator, and I saw that come up on the screen, I was like, oh my God, this is... I was sitting at my kitchen table, and I just slapped my forehead. I was like, this is it, right?
Jason, the thing that really fascinates me is that, going back to this theme of luck versus skill or chance versus skill, I was kind of thinking that maybe that's what makes a game a game, you know, that you've got both some skill and some chance involved, and maybe even in equal amounts.
Right, right. Well, a lot of people in the world of board games and other kinds of games kind of turn their nose up at games of chance, right? Like, if you go all the way down in the ladder, you get to a game like Candyland, the children's game, where you turn over a card, it tells you how far to move, and the game just plays itself based on what cards turn over, and you have no choices to make at all. And a lot of people scoff at that.
So is that why that game is so boring?
Yeah, there's no skill, there's no choices to make. On the other end of the spectrum is a game like chess or a game like Go. You know, the game doesn't play itself at all, and you're sitting there kind of like just... Oh, it's raw brain power against raw brain power. Whoever can kind of think deeper into this gigantic tree of possibilities.
So there's no chance. It's all skill. But on the other hand, I'm not sure I'd say it's fun.
I would describe chess as a dry game as a game designer. And, you know, it's not something that people play for laughs, really, I guess. So kind of in the middle is this perfect sweet spot, right? And this is the spot where games like poker, games that actually have a huge amount of cultural currency reside, including most sports, right? I mean, the sports have this enormous element of skill, right? Like, how fast can you pitch a ball? How accurate can you pitch it? But when someone goes to swing at that ball, there's a ton of chaos involved there in terms of exactly where the ball is going to go and how far it's going to go and what angle it's going to fly at and so on. Mm. So these things that really excite us and that create these moments that are sort of once-in-a-lifetime moments. You know, when you play poker and you, every once in a while, every, you know, 200 and so hands, you get dealt two aces in Texas Hold'em. I mean, it really feels like you turn up those little cards on the table, those little pieces of paper, and there's two A's staring back at you. And it feels like, you know, all the universe has swirled around you just for that moment to bless you with this amazing thing.
You just won the cosmic lottery.
Yeah, yeah. And so those kinds of experiences, those, oh my gosh, I can't believe this just happened to me, or, you know, oh my gosh, I can't believe he made that shot in basketball, when there's so much butterfly effect from the moment he like touches the ball to when he releases it out of his hand. Those moments are moments that, you know, sort of go down in history as these legendary things, in part because there's so much chaos.
Do you think of a game as a metaphor for life? Because I was thinking that interplay between randomness, chance, and skill, to a certain extent, that's what life is, right?
Right, right. So, yeah, I guess, you know, games are these microcosms, like almost like little worlds, right, where the sort of laws of the universe are very well defined and known to us. If you think of a game of, you know, baseball or soccer or American football, you know, there's a sort of beginning and a middle and end. There's this time clock running. There's these other elements. And you're trying to sort of chart your way through it in a way that puts you in a victorious position where we kind of know what victory even means, right? Get more runs in the opponent team by the end of the ninth inning, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas in real life, we kind of know the rules, maybe, but not really. Yeah, and we don't know what the victory condition is.
It's a game, but we don't know what it means to win.
Yeah, like I guess we like to sort of operate in these, people call it, in the game design world, they call it the magic circle, right? Where you step into the circle and everything's very well-defined and there's certain rules of behavior inside that circle. And it's also really interesting how much things count inside that circle, right? I mean, you sit down at a game of poker, and you lose, and your $300 or whatever it is gone. You don't say, hey, man, it was just a game. Can I have my money back? In fact, you know, there's all these great stories from history of how much someone has lost in a poker game and how they stuck to it, right? Like my dad's town growing up, someone lost a house in a poker game. Errol Flynn had an island he was going to build a resort on. He lost it in a poker game, right? I mean, there's...
And people people pay up. They don't say, no,
yeah,
it was just a game. You can't have my island.
Yeah. No, come on, man. Oh, it was just a joke. No. We lost it at a game. It's fair and square, and we believe in it. It's like, it is like this kind of law that we will not violate once we've stepped into that circle, right?
Jason Rohrer is one of the top game designers in the world. He's designed first-person shooters, adventure games, and games so conceptual, one is in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. Oh, and also a game made of titanium that's buried somewhere in the Nevada desert and is so futuristic, nobody alive can play it. But what you can play and gamble on for real money is his new game. It's called Cordial Minuet, and if you visit our website, Jason will teach you how to play it at ttbook.org. So now that we've encouraged you to gamble your life away, let's at least help you be successful at it. Steve Paulson sat down to get some advice from Michael Mobison. He's the head of global financial strategies at Credit Suisse and author of the book you're going to need, The Success Equation.
And the simple rule is when there's lots of skill, what happened before is likely to persist into the future. But when there's lots of luck, there's no reason to believe that what's happened before will happen again. And so just having that framework in mind, I think, allows you to better understand the past and the future.
Okay, explain that. If there's lots of skill, it sounds like you're saying the outcomes will be similar in the future. Why would that be the case?
Well, you think about a high skill activity, a very trivial example would be something like a running race. So we know that Usain Bolt is the fastest sprinter in the world. And I suspect, Steve, if we lined up against him and he ran, he would beat us. And if we did it again, he would win again, right? So there'd be enormous amounts of persistence. So to take that on one side of the extreme. On the other hand, if you are a lottery winner and you were lucky enough to have done that, the next week you play, the probability of you winning again would be very low, right? So it's basically a random process. So what happened before gives you no indication of what will happen next.
Right. And yet I'm guessing that we tell stories about whether there's luck involved or whether, you know, what happened was because of our skill. And do we sometimes get lost in our narratives about skill and luck?
It's a huge deal. It's fascinating. So a little sidebar, there's fascinating work by Michael Gazzaniga, who's a neuroscientist, on split brain patients. And the split brain part's important because it allows them to understand the modules of the brain. But to make a long story short, what they found was in the left hemisphere, we have a module they call the interpreter. And the job of the interpreter is to attach causes to effects that it sees. So no matter what happens, your mind creates a narrative to explain that outcome, and then you file it in your brain. Now, here's the key. The interpreter knows nothing of luck. So typically when you observe good outcomes, you assume some good process was behind that, and you observe bad outcomes, you think something bad happened. And the interpreter doesn't make that distinction. So we are constantly confused by narratives, by stories that explain what's happened, and we don't take into consideration appropriately the role of luck.
Can you give me some examples of this? I mean, what might be some activities that we think are mostly a matter of luck, but actually there's a lot of skill involved?
Usually it doesn't go usually the other way around is where people get confused, right? They think there's a lot of skill and there's a lot more luck. You know, one example that's a very clear one would be professional sports leagues. So what we're able to do is look at professional sport leagues, and we can actually use some quantitative methods to do this and actually place them on the continuum quite accurately. So, for example, the NBA is a sport that contains the most skill, or skill is the most dominant in that sport, whereas something like ice hockey tends to be most random. And the way we do this quantitatively, without getting into the boring details, is we say, what would the world look like if only luck mattered, right? So for every sports game, simply you would flip a coin and whoever called it right would win that game. And then we examine from an empirical point of view how far we depart from that scenario. And that range of departure allows us to then estimate the relative contributions of skill and luck. So there's an example, and if you, by the way, just in terms of rank order, it goes NBA, and then it's Premier League Soccer, then Major League Baseball, then the NFL, and then the NHL. The NHL is a sport with the most randomness in it. And I'll mention something else that was sort of it's been the most talked about part of the book. And it's something that I call the paradox of skill. I want to be clear, it's not my idea. But the paradox of skill says when you think about skill, you have to think it on two dimensions. The first is absolute skill. And I think if we look around the world today, whether it's investing or business or sports, I think we could generally agree that absolute skill has never been higher. But the second dimension is relative skill, which is the difference between the very best and the average. And what we've seen in these same domains is a collapsing of relative skill. So the difference between the very best and the average is less today than in generations before. So when you think about something like the NHL, as you point out, the scoring dimensions and just the best players are only on the ice a certain percentage of the time and so forth. But there's another way to think about it, which is essentially if the skills are equally matched, then luck is going to determine the outcome.
Yeah.
Right. So it doesn't matter how, if you and I are playing tennis, if we're evenly matched, then luck will be much more important. So it's this sort of paradoxical idea that in many cases, as skill goes up, absolutely, it collapses relatively, and more is being left to luck. And this is a really interesting idea that in the world, more and more is being left to luck, not because people are not skillful, but rather because their skill is becoming more uniform.
You write that the secret to success is the reversion to the mean. Can you explain what that means?
So reversion to the mean is an idea, which is, by the way, very tricky, but it says that outcomes that are far from average will be followed by outcomes with an expected value closer to the average. So that's a mouthful, right? But it basically says something like to always realize whenever you're seeing extreme outcomes and there's luck involved, you should anticipate that the next outcome will be much more close to the average. And it's very difficult for people to do that because as humans, we tend to like to extrapolate things, right? Things will continue as they are forever.
Well, I mean, let's talk about gambling. I mean, it would seem like the obvious case of someone's at the roulette wheel is on a hot streak. Are you saying that you should assume that hot streak is going to end?
Of course. Yeah, and of course. And gambling, there are a lot of things that also the outcomes, if it's assuming everything is fair, these are random outcomes, right? So they're independent and random. So, yeah, there is no such thing as a hot streak, right? So there are people that win in successions or lose in successions. But
what do you mean there's no such thing as a hot streak? I mean, people at the gambling table talk about hot streaks all the time.
Yeah, that's all contained within what you would expect from probability theory. For example, as you know, you have 1,000 people and you flip coins 20 times or 30 times, you know there'll be a statistical distribution where some people will call them all right, some will call them all wrong. We know that a priori just based on the statistics of it. If you happen to be the person calling it right or wrong, you're going to feel like you're on a hot streak or you're really lucky or really skillful. But we know, again, statistically, that's well contained and explained by what we would just expect by randomness.
Okay, what about a hot streak that an athlete is on? You know, an athlete who's in the zone. And I mean, there was a great example this year in the NBA. Klay Thompson goes off in one NBA game, sets the NBA record for points scored in a quarter, 37 points in the third quarter in one game. He's never come close to that before, probably will never do that again. How should we look at that?
There are two ideas here. The first is, and this has been talked about a lot, is the idea of a hot hand. Right. So you're the guy who's hot. We pass you the ball and you keep making shots. Now, the hot hand initially about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, there's a paper that basically debunked it. They looked at NBA data and said basically this doesn't exist. So that's one thing.
Wait, how can we say it's not? I mean, we can watch a game and we can see this person has the touch right now. You feed him the ball. He keeps making shot after shot. How could that not be?
So the key point, Steve, is it's within probability. In other words, it's within probability. So the second thing I'll say is that when you see streaks in sports, and this would be, you know, Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak or a player making consecutive field goals in basketball. So basically streaks, those outliers are great skill plus great luck. And if you think about it, that sort of has to be true. So saying this differently, not all skillful players have streaks, but all the streaks are held by skillful players, right? Because skill is the prerequisite and luck comes on top.
So do you kind of look at the world through the lens of probability?
I personally do. And I think that writing this book, by the way, has really made me much more mindful of a lot of these concepts. And I think that, again, going back to this concept of the interpreter, this part of our brain that's creating causes for every effect we see, we naturally are spinning narratives around us to sort of weave together a cohesive world. And when you introduce these ideas about probabilities and luck and skill, I think it gives you a very different take on many situations, hopefully a more refined take on things. And again, the key is to allow you to better understand what has happened, but much more importantly, again, a better way of thinking about what is likely to happen. So just a much richer, I think a much richer way of thinking about what happens in the world.
So I have to ask, do you believe at all in fate or destiny?
No.
Why am I not surprised?
No. It's a probably more complicated answer than that. But no, the answer would be no. And I think this idea of things that are preordained or deterministic, certainly that's not a way of thinking that is attractive to me.
Michael Mobuson is the managing director and head of global financial strategies at Credit Suisse. His book is called The Success Equation. He also created some simple online games as examples of some of the things he and Steve were talking about, and you can play them on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about skill versus luck. You know, most of us spend a lot of our lives trying to acquire more and better skills. But choreographer Bill T. Jones says his mentor, the musician John Cage, spent a lot of his life pursuing luck. Bill says Cage's music is all about randomness and chance.
His world was changing. It was the Cold War. He didn't know if the kind of modernist music that he was in pursuit of was, quote, speaking to the world. He had a long-term marriage to a wonderful woman who was his collaborator, and he was no longer in love with her, but falling in love with Merce Cunningham. There was a lot of insecurity he had until one of his teachers, actually his Eastern teacher, said, John, you don't have to have the answer to everything. And when he realized that, he began to look for means. And one of those means was the I Ching and indeterminacy. How do you make decisions? Toss the I Ching. Why is your opinion or your choice more important than what the sticks tell you or the coins tell you? It was a revelation for him. Do I marry this woman or marry this man or not? Let's toss a coin. No, I don't think I would do that. However, when you're doing something like, you know, there's a sequence of movements to be had, and you're just, that you like them all well enough, but you're not quite sure, well, he says, toss a coin and let the coin tell you. theme, variation, development, climax, he thought was a big straitjacket, a real predictable arc. And for art to progress, you had to get rid of that which was predictable in it. You're really trying to wade out into the water of those that want to lead the discourse. You've got to break all those rules and maybe turn your back on what feels good. In 1999, we premiered a work in three parts called We Set Out Early, Visibility Was Poor. The second section, Cape Bardo, was performed to a recording of John Cage performing Empty Words at the Teatro Lirico in Milan. The audience of revolutionary students began to riot in response to Cage's reading Walden Pond. Not the text as written, but phonemes or word fragments chosen by chance procedure. Later, over dinner, Stephen Wright, a manager of symphony orchestras, said of both Cage and Schoenberg, "For practically 70 years, conductors and impresarios have been trying to force this stuff on audiences. When will they realize people just don't like it? Audiences simply don't want it. It doesn't work." The concert that I was just reading about there was reported to me by a dear friend of his and mine. That's how I know him, through Betty Freeman, a great supporter of contemporary music. She happened to be there that night in 1978 when the students actually were so shocked that this revolutionary artist they'd been told about was not revolutionary in the political sense, but in aesthetic sense. They literally stormed the stage, drank his water, knocked his glasses off, and he kept going with Empty Words. 2 hours he keeps going with those phonemes, and you hear the audience turn into a roaring wave of oppositional forces, screaming, chanting, until half of them leave, and he continues the concert.
Hello. Light bells, large smooth pines.
Artists, and if I dare say, in the same breath with John Cage, we are a perverse bunch. I think people often say, are you just trying to shock people? Well, no, you have an idea that is scary to you. And you think you're going to put that idea up there and see what it does. And you're holding on with, my hands are black. I'm a black man, but I'll say with white knuckles. How is it going to fly? You don't know. And sometimes, even when the answer comes back to you in the form of an audience full of applause, you're still wondering, what did this mean? I think he was a brave pioneer, saying to us, those of you who want to be artists, realize that it is something more like a religious calling than anything else. It is a test of your faith, every new piece that you make. So yeah, do your best work, do your scariest work, but realize you will find there's no succor here. There's no safe harbor here. He is the one that, for some reason, never fails, because he never really promised anything. He never promised anything other than, if you want to know what to do next, do the next thing. What?
Choreographer Bill T. Jones, talking about his mentor and friend, the musician John Cage. Cage died in 1992. But if you want to hear some more of that historic performance, including the riot, we found a 33-minute sample and put it on our website. It's at ttbook.org. In 2004, Annie Duke was in the final of the World Series of Poker. She was up against the top two poker players in the world, Phil Hellmuth and the other one who just happened to be her older brother. The jackpot was $2 million. Now, if you know poker, you know what happened next. Annie won. But that's not the point. It's how she won that's legendary. It was near the end of the game, and Annie drew two sixes. Phil folded. Her older brother then got two sevens. And at that point, Annie's chance of winning was just 18.5%. She told Charles Monroe Kane what happened next.
And then I hit the six, and I had multiple emotions. You know, I was obviously very happy to see the six, but I was obviously, right. also very sad to see the six because I wasn't really rooting against my brother. If I'm going to knock my brother out of the tournament, I don't want it to be on some stupid bad beat that I put on him where, you know, he has the much better hand.
You got lucky, right?
It depends on what you mean by luck. Like, luck is a weird word because there's this colloquial use of the word and then there's a more technical use of the word. If by luck you mean that I had a negative EV on the hand and I won it, yes, I got
very lucky. 18.5% is pretty bad.
Yeah.
Do you view that as a lucky moment? At the time, you sat back in your hotel room later, chilling, $2 million surrounding you, and you're like, damn, I got lucky? Or how did that happen?
Yeah, it was definitely a lucky moment. I just, like, in my colloquial use, like, people think of luck, like bad luck, as just something bad happened to them, and good luck is something good happened to them. I think about it as when you're kind of on the bad end of what your expected value is. So you're setting some sort of expected value. So for example, let's say that we were betting on flipping a coin and I was taking heads and I happened to flip heads 3 times in a row, which is only going to happen 12.5% of the time. In my everyday life, I would say, oh, I got really lucky to have that happen. And you got unlucky to have that happen to you, that you happened to lose that 3 times in a row. But in a more technical sense, you can kind of think about there's another step, which is you can be very low percentage to win something, but still be making an excellent bet and actually still be making money on the bet. So I could have a hand that's only going to win 20% of the time, which means that for every dollar that I bet, I need to be winning $4 on the times that I won in order to break even. If I bet a dollar where I'm going to win $5 on the time that I win, then I'm making a really good bet. I'm going to win money, but I'm expecting that I'm going to lose that 80% of the time. So when I lose that particular hand, I don't really think of it as bad luck because I'm kind of supposed to lose it 80% of the time. And when I win it, I'm not necessarily thinking good luck because, well, it was just 20%. And I'm thinking more about the investment that I made.
Right.
So I think the difference is that when poker players are thinking about luck, they're adding this extra step, which is what your expected value is. Whereas when you're using it in your everyday life, you don't have that kind of extra step of what was the expected value.
Well, what about everyday life? I mean, you've been dealing with this a long time. I'm sure you've brought this to a little metaphorical value. You're a mom, you're a wife, you're a world citizen. Do you look at this? Well, 18.5%.
So I do. And I think that what happens is that poker players are dealing with uncertainty all the time, which is really where luck comes from, right? Like in chess, there's no luck because there's no uncertainty. There isn't this random element where you can't really predict the outcome necessarily and random things happen. If you're going through a traffic intersection and you are following the rules and you only go when it's green, that doesn't mean you're not going to get hit, right? Because it's not a zero variance game. So I think that because I play poker, I don't sort of ruminate and think, you know, sort of get like, oh, I got so unlucky, I can't believe that, and start getting really upset by it. Because I think that I'm taking into account like a certain percentage of the time things aren't going to work out and a certain percentage of the time they are. So I think about it very probabilistically that nothing's 100%.
You know, it makes me think about from another poker player, Phil Hellmuth has this great quote, if it weren't for luck, I'd win every time.
Well, so I actually now do a lot of consulting and speaking to executives. And in every talk that I give that quote from
really?
Phil Hellmuth, funnily enough.
That's
yes,
awesome.
And I have a picture of him with the quote, if it weren't for luck, I'd win every one. And what I say is the problem with that is that on both sides, it's really bad. It's saying if you took luck out of the equation, then my decision making is perfect. And that's bad for both reasons. If you chalk bad things that happen to you up to bad luck, there's nothing to be learned from it. You're just sort of ruminating on your bad luck, right? And kind of not thinking about, well, what was the learning experience I could have from it? But on the flip side, if you attribute good things that happen to you to skill, which is what we tend to do, so we flip it, right? Like
right.
The bad things are, something bad happened to me, I had such bad luck. The good things are, oh, look at what a great decision maker I am. Then you're not looking to see if that was because you actually made a decision and had good luck. Like, in the hand was my brother. I'm perfectly willing to admit to you that I had the worst hand and I got lucky to win it because my expected value was negative there. And you want to be examining that as well. And I think that that particular thinking error is one of the most prevalent thinking errors. It has a name. It's actually called the fundamental attribution error.
Okay.
When bad things happen to us, we say, oh, that was bad luck. When good things happen to us, we say, oh my gosh, look at how great I am. When bad things happen to other people, we say, what an idiot. And when good things happen to them, we say, oh, they got lucky. It's very common.
You know, you have a quote on your website that I don't fully understand it. I've been trying to understand it recently, and it's kind of a big quote on the front of your website. It says, tilt usually arises from something you don't have a lot of control over. Can you mm-hmm. help me understand the bigger meaning of that one?
Sure. So tilt is a term that poker players use that means the state of being emotionally out of control because of something that happened that then causes you to make bad decisions going forward. So it's a long concept. It's a very important concept. And, you know, with important concepts, you come up with one word to describe it in whatever idiom you're using. So poker players came up with tilt because it's something that they actually talk about all the time.
Do you mind giving an example of that?
Sure.
Okay.
I get all my money in with aces and somebody else has 2-5. So I'm going to win that hand 82% of the time-ish. And I lose the hand and I lose a bunch of my chips. And now I just start playing every bad hand that comes my way.
Right.
Because I'm just so upset that I lost the hand. So that's being on tilt. In life, it's like you see people on tilt all the time. It's like they get in a fight with their girlfriend and all of a sudden they're at a bar on their 17th beer. You know, it's like
right.
That's going on tilt. So most people, when they lose that hand with the aces, get really emotionally off center and they become very not decision fit. So they make really bad decisions going forward, where a more rational person would say, I had aces, the other person had fives, I had the best hand, nothing after that was in my control whatsoever. All right, so 18.5% of the time I'm going to lose that, I lost it, let's move on to the next hand, I can be comfortable knowing I made a really good decision. But that's very hard for people to do because it's that, you know, why did that happen to me? Why was I so unlucky? I made such a good decision and then this horrible thing happened to me. And now they can't really get their frontal lobes engaged anymore. Their temporal lobe is now just taken over and their limbic system is on fire. And they tend to lose all their chips after that. So keeping control really matters. And it's what keeps you in control is the ability to recognize what was in my control and what wasn't. And I'm not going to ruminate about the things that weren't.
That's Annie Duke. She won the 2004 World Series of Poker Championship and the Heads Up Poker Championship in 2010. She now lectures on the science of smart decision-making. Charles Monroe Kane talked with her. And hey, if you want to see that epic 2004 moment when Annie Duke became the world poker champion by drawing that historic six, the video's on our website. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Julie Schumacher, author of Dear Committee Members, and my bookmark recommendation is José Saramago's The Elephant's Journey, written in Portuguese but published in English in 2010. This short novel reimagines an odd historical incident from the 1500s the King of Portugal offers as a wedding present to his cousin, the Archduke of Austria, an elephant named Solomon, who then, accompanied by appropriate regal fanfare, makes the long voyage, mainly on foot, over the Alps from Lisbon to Vienna. The elephant has a trainer, a mahout from India, and he worries a lot about his relations with the royals who are on the trip, about pleasing them. At one moment, the elephant is asked by a priest to kneel down in front of the church to show that he is a creature of the faith. And the Indian elephant driver needs to make that happen. The pilgrimage of the elephant Solomon and his entourage is strangely fanciful and comic, the point of view shifting from one character to another. In one passage, the elephant Solomon admits feeling anxious about, quote, his grayish coffee color, sprinkled with freckles and hairs. It was a permanent disappointment to him, despite the advice he was always giving to himself about accepting his fate. Saramago's trademark prose style, the phrases and sentences unlatched from one another and curiously recombined in a breathless, semi-punctuated fashion, can take a bit of getting used to. But a few pages into the novel, the effect is wonderfully hypnotic. The narrator darts like a buzzing insect through the paragraphs, reappearing unexpectedly here and there to make pronouncements or to ask questions about grammar, war, God, marriage, class, race, geography, and human-animal relations. Quote, it is time to warn the reader that two of the characters here are not acting in good faith, unquote, the narrator says. In the hands of a lesser writer, such interruptions would be annoying, but in The Elephant's Journey, they are seamlessly woven into the text. I worry that someone listening to this recommendation might decide that The Elephant's Journey sounds difficult, experimental, inaccessible. But Saramago's novel is funny, poignant, and deeply moving. This is not weighty historical fiction. It's a very contemporary and remarkably cheerful flight of fancy. By retelling the wildly improbable story of an elephant traversing the Alps almost 500 years ago, Saramago creates a one-of-a-kind journey for the reader as well. As one of the characters in the novel ultimately concludes in a moment of celebration, it isn't every day that an elephant appears in our lives.
Julie Schumacher recommends The Elephant's Journey by Jose Saramago. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. So we've been talking about luck and skill in this hour, and one of the biggest wagers in the world is playing out in Europe right now. Will Greece be able to pay off its debts? I know this is across the Atlantic and far away, but the Greek debt crisis could wind up having a lot more impact on your life and mine than most of us realize. British historian Adam Tooze has been following the crisis, and he stopped by our studio to tell Steve Paulson just how much is at stake.
Professor Tooze, we hear a lot about the tensions within the European Union, especially Greece's demands to have its debt reduced, and there seems to be a larger question about whether the EU is starting to crack apart. Do you think Europe, as a political and economic entity, is in trouble?
It's very difficult to judge because the remarkable thing about the Eurozone crisis since 2010 is the sheer persistence and the energy and the commitment of resource that has gone into getting us this far. You know, a very large collection of countries with really quite divergent interests in trying to hold this system together.
So it's not as if anything's getting resolved here. It's just sort of, it's this lingering crisis. It's probably going to keep dragging on.
Well, this is the other thing. I mean, we have to get used to this, I think, as a crisis in slow motion. This is not the sort of crisis which is suddenly going to explode and suddenly resolve itself. Unlike the American story, where really crisis management cut in, and by 2009, we'd sutured the crisis more or less. The stimulus package was working. And so, in a sense, America begins to recover. Europe has this protracted crisis. One can imagine almost a decade of prolonged financial crisis in Europe beginning in 2007 and perhaps not being resolved for many years to come.
That's interesting. So you're saying that the Great Recession that goes back to, say, 2007, I mean, that hasn't ended in Europe.
No, absolutely not. No, it began there with a banking crisis, which is now largely forgotten. And it was a banking crisis that concerned the rich countries, which are now calling the shots with regard to Greece. So Germany has an epic banking crisis, which is swept under the carpet by the German government itself. And one possible scenario, of course, is that they have done enough work for them to be able to let Greece go. We mustn't forget just blank politics here. The German government is a right-wing government. It's a coalition of conservatives and market-orientated liberals who are dealing...
And Greece now has this newly elected...
The most left-wing government elected within the EU possibly ever, certainly since the end of the Cold War. And the German conservatives are in no mood to make concessions to them.
Okay, let's play this out then. I mean, Greece, of course, has demanded that its debt be forgiven. It has balked against all these very severe austerity measures. Suppose Greece just leaves the Eurozone.
So then there are two scenarios for the Eurozone. One is that that is then interpreted as the end of the crisis and the truly insupportable member of the Eurozone is let go and that becomes a kind of curative break. So then the alternative scenario is, and what as it were drives people who desperately want to keep the Greeks in, is that we get a form of contagion again, like we saw during the height of the first Eurozone crisis in 2010-2011. And the absolutely crucial variable here is Italy. And on every single metric, Italy is one of the most heavily indebted states in the world. It's up there with Japan in terms of its debt to GDP ratio. And it's so large that it couldn't easily be bailed out.
Hmm. Well, there is this, I think, underlying assumption that capitalism in Europe is kind of different from elsewhere. Mm. It's like different from American capitalism, for instance. Mm. I mean, it's certainly not socialist, but there's much more government intervention in the whole economic system. Is part of the problem here sort of the state of capitalism in the contemporary world?
I mean, I would argue rather more that rather narcissistic self-image of the Europeans as somehow being exempt from many of the flaws of American capitalism is one of the real obstacles to constructive and immediate action when the crisis really became severe in 2007-2008. So rather than thinking of the European banks as sort of conservative, industrially orientated, long-term investors, in fact, they become the great drivers of the derivative business. They become some of the largest investors in the more toxic end of the American mortgage-backed securities.
So the whole financial system, you almost can't separate what's happening in the United States with Europe.
When the crisis struck, it became immediately apparent that the Fed had to treat all of the major European banks, all of which have representation in the U.S., as though they were American entities, because if any one of them failed, it would have had an effect just as devastating as the Lehman failure. So in effect, the Fed pumps trillions of dollars of liquidity into the European banks directly, the ones which are situated in the US. So Deutsche Bank and Paribas receive hundreds of billions of dollars in direct credit provision from the Fed.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that we had this huge economic crisis, the Great Recession back in 2008. It's waiting to happen again.
It's still going on in a sense. And we have somehow, well, I mean, quite deliberately from 2010 onwards, as part of the kind of Austerian turn of that moment, constructed a narrative in which the European crisis is different and it's about badly behaved democracies and badly behaved left-wing Greeks, even more particularly. But of course, the immediate crisis in 2010 was that the French and German banks were up to their necks in lending to that irresponsible Greek government.
Now, we should point out that you are actually a historian. You are not just a political analyst or an economist. And you've written a book on the reordering of the global order after World War I. I mean, going back 100 years, what launched from that was what has been called the American century. Yeah. I mean, the U.S. has been the dominant power, really, for the last century. Yeah. The question, of course, is how long will that last?
Yes, and the Chinese are by no means, as it were, pushing to the forefront. It's evident to them as well, I think, that it's only on a rather refined and rather technical measure of GDP per capita. The Chinese now are the biggest economy in the world. If you actually look at their ability to fund, say, military spending or infrastructure spending, they're still a country of middle income, very highly organized, very dynamic, but still basically a middle income country.
And the assumption is China is basically biding its time, growing its power to become the dominant world power. Right?
And right now, I think it's still some way away from this, and it knows it very well, and its geographic position is never going to put it in the position that the United States is. So I don't think there's any inevitability about a rapid, you know, decline of the West. There's a great symmetry and kind of pleasing logic to the reassertion of the great Asian nations that for, you know, roughly 200 years were in the shadow of Europe to an absurd extent. And
So this may not be a bad thing.
This
is
may
what
not
you're
be
saying.
A bad
I mean,
thing,
sort of, I mean,
the, but what the... is a bad thing is the extent to which we're screwing things up. What is a bad thing is the extent to which we're failing to manage this crisis. That clearly is where we need to be asking hard questions. It's not.
And when you say managing the crisis, you're talking about the economic crisis.
The economic, well, not just. I mean, there are basic questions, surely, about the social priorities. societies, of rich and affluent societies, that are choosing, you know, to spend grotesquely on, say, armaments, for instance. America is the most massively over-armed power the world has ever seen.
Doesn't that come with the territory of being a superpower?
No superpower has ever remotely demanded or insisted upon or claimed for itself the preponderance that America does today. There's no single example in history in which one state could, as it were, effectively outweigh, in fact, more than outweigh the total combined military power of all other states on the entire planet. And the mere fact that it's taken for granted in the U.S. is in and of itself deeply puzzling.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. You are called upon to be the advisor of, I don't know, the U.S. president or something like that, and to come up with a... I know, asking a Brit to do this is a little odd, but...
We fantasize about it always. Just look at the figures in West Wing. You know, there's that wonderful lord who floats into Jed Bartlett's office and, you know, drives Liam McGarrity crazy. Yeah.
Anyway, but to reconceptualize the proper American role in the world, what would it be?
I mean, I actually think that this is a line beloved by many people in Washington, and Kissinger uses this line as well, which is that, as it were, almost all of America's problems are homegrown. So I think one of the things which would help to reestablish American credibility is a sense that certain very fundamental aspects of its domestic governance were in better shape than they are. I personally do think that a clear set of signals in the Middle East, which I think the Obama administration has to a degree been trying to sign, and we've now seen...
What kinds of clear signals?
Well, in the sense that a two-state solution is just indispensable, and that
for Israel.
For Israel, and that no deviation from that is possible, that furthermore military action against Iran is it just simply can't happen. Outwardly, I think the promotion of tighter and closer and more effective integration economically with the EU is the obvious route to go.
What you're suggesting then is that the United States sort of sees itself as going alone, having to be the leader of the pack. You're saying
it needs to consistently look for partnership and alliance with actors who've demonstrated, and one surely have to single out the Chinese and the EU. If one takes the financial crisis as the great sort of really earth-shaking event of the last 10 years, then both of them have demonstrated themselves to be partners with the United States in managing, you know, the truly essential guts of the world system, which are its economic functioning. And the Chinese in particular have been extraordinarily cooperative. And so, you know, the tendency of the American strategic community to envision various types of scenario in which we militarize the standoff with the Chinese, I mean, it seems to me a disastrous misunderstanding. For a historian, it's very difficult not to sort of wax nostalgic about the phase between 1941 and the early 1950s, where one really does see on the part of the American State Department, the Treasury, and indeed the succession of presidents, FDR, Truman, and Eisenhower, a truly integrated conception of global power and Cold War strategy. And the lack of that in American policymaking over the last 20 years, I think, is really terrifying, frankly, in its implications.
Adam Tooze is a historian at Yale and author of The Deluge, The Great War, America, and the Remaking of the Global Order, 1916 to 1931. Steve Paulson talked with him. That's it for this hour, but you can listen to lots of hours of To the Best of Our Knowledge when you subscribe to our podcast. You'll find us on iTunes. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show. He had help from Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.